Two Corners of the World, it's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. I'm your co-host, Nick Cooey. Joining me, as always, is Alex Cooey. He is located just on the outskirts of Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am nestled here in the little town of Beaconsfield, Great Britain, and today is November the 23rd, 2020. And Alex, how are you doing on this late fall day? I know that as we're recording, things are looking a little dicey in terms of people's Thanksgiving Day plans.
Things have been a bit dicey for a while now, and what we personally are trying to do here at our house is we're just trying to play it safe, you know, and we're going to have a very low key Thanksgiving. Though we've got some concoctions come up in our head that could make things a little fun still. But just try and play it safe, stay home, you know, social distancing, wash your hands, wear masks, all that good stuff. What about you? I mean, I know there's also been I know that bars were closed a while back, but I know that there have been a high number of cases too in the United Kingdom.
Well, you know, the thing is, I mean, we are kind of going through sort of our own lockdown. We can go to school and interact with people, but all social gatherings are practically all social gatherings are prohibited right now. I mean, the only thing that you can really do socially with another person is go for a walk. Or if you're going to be in another person's household, you can only be in one other household and limit that to just either one or two other households that are within a particular house. I mean, it's a little convoluted, but basically, yeah. We're pretty limited in terms of what we can do for social gatherings, but it's a sobering time in a lot of ways, and not to say this is going to be a sobering episode, but I think we're going to be talking about to transition into the meat of the thing, Not to say that, you know, now to talk about something light and different, because we're not going to be really talking about something light. It'll be different, but I did want to get to the core topic of what we're talking about today, and that's something that you brought to my attention. I've kind of noticed in some publications recently that it was the 40th anniversary. We did an episode earlier in the year, for anybody who heard it, of The Empire Strikes Back. And so we decided that we're going to do another 40th anniversary episode, and this time of Martin Scorsese's boxing pick, Raging Bull, which I'm sure, you know, like The Empire Strikes Back, one or two of you have seen at some point in your lives. But
I feel like, you know, when it comes to probably the two or three most, important movies of 1980, I'm convinced, the top two films, at least, on a lot of people's list would be number two, Empire Strikes Back, and number one, Raging Bull. I mean, those really are
probably the third most.
The third one, I would argue, is Elephant Man.
The third most important is probably Heaven's Gate.
Or Heaven's Gate. Oh yeah, that's actually a good choice too. But
I mean, whether that's a great film or not, that's always been and always will be, I think, a point of contention. But unquestionably, that film could warrant its own discussion. But we're not going to be talking about Heaven's Gate.
No,
today.
Even though it's interesting because of not just the fact that it was released by United Artists, which also released Raging Bull, but because Raging Bull was, when it came out, I mean, everybody now, when they talk about it, everyone's like, well, of course, it's like a seminal American classic. But upon its release, it wasn't initially considered a masterpiece by everyone. In fact, the critical reception was a bit more mixed, and even the box office performance wasn't exactly spectacular.
Well, right, and because this had to, I mean, and there was a lot writing on this film, wasn't there, for this to be kind of a sort of a comeback picture for Scorsese? Am I mistaken in that?
Well, you know, and I think it did end up being a comeback picture from some ways, because he was at a point, people could argue, both creatively and certainly a personal low, for himself at that point in life, because he had to, you know, it was mid-1970s, like 77, 78, he had released his musical film New York, New York with Bobby De Niro and Liza Minnelli, which wasn't a box office hit and wasn't a critical success, you know. So it was his really first attempt to try and make like more big-budget filmmaking as opposed to the more nitty-gritty low-budget pictures he had done like with Taxi Driver and Mean Streets. And so that kind of put him in a depression funk. And plus, in 77, he actually got a divorce from his second wife at the time, Julia Cameron. So, and then as many people, many cinephiles know the story, how it goes, like around that time, he had been a heavy drug user. Like he had a bit of a heavy cocaine addiction that actually almost killed him in 78. Mm-hmm. And while all that was going on, like De Niro actually had first to pitched him to make this move, the story of Jake LaMotta, into a movie back actually in the early 70s. He showed him the book of Raging Bull on the set of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And he was like, well, this isn't a very well-written book, but I think this character is very interesting. I think there could be a good movie out of this. But Marty wasn't so sure because, he knew next to nothing about boxing. He never considered himself a boxing fan. I mean, having him direct a boxing picture was like having Barton Fink write a boxing picture, you know? But after his near-death experience, it was kind of like, there was like this kind of drive, like, okay, I'm going to make this film. And he actually felt like maybe this would be his last movie. And so there was a bit riding onto it, yeah. And it was his second attempt, I think, at making a more big-budget Hollywood film, and actually even reuniting with a lot of the same people who worked in New York, New York. Like, the producers were Irwin Winkler and Robert Chartoff, who actually produced another famous boxing film, Rocky, which is interesting because this is a very different film from Rocky. In fact, someone called it the anti-Rocky, which I think is true. So
right,
all that going for it. And yet, I wanted to talk about this because I felt like this was in many ways a turning point for Scorsese personally and for his career, because I think those who did respond and did acknowledge and realize the masterpiece it was, then realized like, okay, this guy, you know, it's kind of like it was like the next step in evolution for him as a director. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't just a guy who made these like memorable and great gritty 70s New York set films, but he was somebody who not only had an excellent knowledge of cinema, but he had a very clear, distinct identity that he could carry through into bigger budgets and could not get lost, like with all the technical complications and what have you.
Well, I mean, I think those are all really valid points, but I wanted to actually just kind of step away from that really quickly. I wanted to step away from kind of a little bit of the background of the production, as well as the fact that it's, of course, based on a true story about Jake LaMotta, the boxer, and his troubled rise and fall as a successful athlete, and his difficult personal life at home with his brother slash manager, as well as his wife. But I wanted to strip away a little bit of the context, or at least like not quite get into the context yet, to just sort of start at a simple question, which is that, of course, looking past the film, sort of that Raging Bull, the film itself has such a really storied legacy and reputation around it. What were your initial impressions seeing it? Or I should ask too, when was the first time that you saw Raging Bull?
Oh, gosh. It was a long time ago. I think I want to say 7-8 years ago was the first time I saw it. And it was kind of during that period where I think because I had an interesting relationship with Marty Scorsese, because I first really became aware, I first started getting into his films starting with The Aviator. And I thought they were fine movies, but I couldn't quite see what all the hubbub about him was. Mm-hmm. But then I went back to some of his earlier films and I liked those even more. And so when I saw Raging Bull, I did think to myself of how I was kind of awestruck and floored by just the precision of his direction, the way he executes the sequences and puts them all together. Like, of course, not just the boxing sequences and the different flavors and personalities he gives them, but also with the performances and the black and white imagery and like and the sort of the impressionistic qualities he gives to even the day to the domestic life of Jake, like when he cuts to slow motion or what have you, that always stuck out to me when I first saw it. And I did think to myself, like, yeah, after watching this, because I had heard about it, of course, on lots of top 10 lists and what have you over the years as one of the greatest films of all time. But when I saw it, it was one of those movies where, yeah, I could definitely see why it was hailed as such a, and so widely regarded as a classic. What about you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I first saw the film about a decade ago. A little, yeah. Yeah, back in 2010, I remember. I was kind of going on a binge of watching a bunch of movies, and then I was thinking to myself, what's a classic that I haven't seen before? And of course, I came down to Raging Bull, and we had a copy of it on DVD, and I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to see what all the fuss is about. And yeah, I mean, just kind of watching it as on its own merits, as a film by itself. I mean, the one thing that I was really struck by was how, well, from what I remembered of it the first time, the thing that kind of left an impression on me was the very stripped back quality of a lot of the film. I mean, you're right, it has a lot of impressionistic flourishes, some of which we'll talk about even a little more, but you've already raised up in terms of Scorsese's use of slow motion to approximate Jake's subjective perspective, really. I mean, because the film is a character portrait, but it's also really we're seeing the film through Jake's eyes to a certain extent. I mean, there's one sequence where he's not in the film that kind of breaks away from that. But yeah, I think that the film, to me, just coming to it, expecting a boxing movie, there are boxing scenes in the film, but really, after a certain point, the context around these fights, it doesn't matter insofar as that, oh, he's going to beat this one guy so he'll be able to advance to this next circuit and then try to get the title for middleweight champion, you know, because he was a middleweight boxer. It's not even focused on that. Every fight in the film is very much specifically dictated by some sort of a character motivation from Jake. I mean, it's the ring, I think as several critics have kind of pointed out, the ring operates as a stage for him to perform. I mean, he even says it in the opening. He likens, like, performing on the stage to performing in the ring. That's entertainment, as he says. And it's less that it's entertainment as much as it's a conduit for him to channel a lot of his whatever emotional turmoil he's going through at the moment in terms of either his competitive drive, his ego, his pathological jealousy, which really becomes a core element that causes some of the downfall that we see in the second half of the film. But to me, again, I think despite knowing that the film would follow a certain trajectory, it really felt surprisingly and refreshingly devoid of cliches. And yeah, coming back to it now, you know, watching it again pretty recently for this podcast, I think the thing that actually makes the film 40 years later feel really viscerally potent still is that it is one of the most unsparing portraits of toxic male rage that's ever been put to the screen. I mean, I think it's something which in 1980 was certainly not... I don't think anybody was really quite making a film of this raw power or to this extent. But in the interim between 1980 and 2020, we have seen a lot of films and particularly television shows that are about white male antiheroes who are motivated in part or chiefly even by their rage. And of course, Scorsese's revisited this particular thematic strain time and again with movies like The Wolf of Wall Street and even in other stuff like The Irishman, which is not as much about kind of male rage, but it is very much a male-dominated schema. And I mean, but that's a lot of his
film. And that had also been apparent in his earlier works, too, before that, like Taxi Driver, mm-hmm. like Mean Streets, you know, even to his debut, Who's That Knocking at My Door?
Right, right. That's a very good point, Alex. So then, I mean, and, you know, having seen those films actually after I saw Raging Bull before I saw Taxi Driver or Who's That Knocking on My Door. And I think that there's something, too, about Raging Bull. The thing that distinguishes Raging Bull from those other films, you can see the groundwork laid for Raging Bull in those earlier works. But the thing that distinguishes Raging Bull, for me, is the sense that Scorsese really balances effectively the operatic with the quotidian. He really tries to, I think, give a sense of this tragic heft of the story that he's telling, but at the same time not be afraid of having his actors improvise. I mean, and Pesci and De Niro improvise quite a bit on the set, and you can actually tell in terms of their exchanges and their dialogue. I think the dynamics between the actors in this film I think that they're very finely attuned towards the nuances of this sort of unspoken credo that toxic male privilege rules unquestioned in a lot of these private spheres, and even within the public spectacle of the ring.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really glad that you singled out the dynamics between the actors. I mean, Marty is always, he has a gift and a knack for like bringing out a dynamic between his actors, I think, in all his movies. And Raging Bull is no exception. Like, you're right, like Pesci and De Niro, they have that sort of, you believe they have that sort of familial brotherly bond, but also it's rooted in, there is a bit of a toxic machismo to it as well, and that you can tell these are both kind of like violent men, but there's still that brotherly love, even though it does almost get fractured permanently because of Jake's own deeply rooted insecurities and paranoia. And also we have Kathy Moriarty as Vicky, Jake's wife. This was like Moriarty's first film role, and she was like 17, 18 when they shot it. So when you have like a young up-and-comer, and this is her first film role, to have like, this is your first movie, and to work against these kinds of actors, and to, you know, and there was, you know, I know there's a little bit of controversy we've discussed about this, and I know people have objected to like the way they feel that Marty portrays his female characters in his movies, and not a lot of his movies I think have female protagonists in them per se. Like, I think Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is the only one I can think of. But I think just because they may not be his protagonists, they're still, he I think provides something interesting to their persona and personality. And I feel Moriarty, he lends something too. Like, there's a kind of...
Well, I think Moriarty, for her, I mean, I think she does a great job in the film as well. I mean, as you said, because it's her first film, and she's also acting against these, you know, when your acting partner is this heavyweight like Robert De Niro, who at this point in his career, of course, I mean, it's Robert De Niro. He's a star, and he's at the height of his powers as a performer. I mean, that's intimidating, but you never get the sense that she's intimidated. And I think that's in part because the character that Vicky, she never can feel really intimidated by Jake. I mean, she is, I think, in some respect that, but at the same time, she constantly calls him out on his boorish behavior and his brutal, just overreaction to any sort of perceived slight that she might be dallying about with other men, when in fact she's just simply living her own life. And he has this real possessive rage. And yeah, I think it is that is an interesting question too about the film's sexual politics, because the film is very much about several misogynistic, homophobic, racist white men. And it's something, you know, Alex, when we were revisiting Raging Bull, it's something to me that I was kind of wondering, how does this film hold up in 2020 with especially with kind of the cultural and political climate that America has undergone within the last 5 years of just this, of either of Me Too, and of course, you know, the fact that we've, you know, to not get too political about the current incumbent who shall be leaving the White House shortly, but the fact that we've elected a racist, misogynist pig as president. And there's always that question, you know, of like, or the pitfall, I should say, of when you're presenting the subject matter, at what point are you deconstructing or criticizing this sort of behavior, and at what point are you inherently glorifying it simply through representation? Because as because the film is so beholden to Jake's perspective, we don't really get the perspective or the motive of any of the other characters. And there's this interesting question of when we see a character like Vicky, she doesn't leave. We'd never really have a clear reason or given a clear indication of why she chooses to be with Jake. The only scene that when they meet is that it's kind of a stilted, very terse exchange where Jake's not really much of a talker, but he's willing to show off his car and she just accepts his invitation for a ride.
Well, yeah, like Joey's the one who does all the talking. You know, he's like, hey, you know, I want you to meet my brother. Hey, you know, hey, Jack, come over here.
De Niro's face is so great in that moment when he gets out of the car and he's ambling over and he looks like he's really cool, hot shit. And he's trying to act cool, but he has all of the self-awareness of a gnat. he's just the guy just clearly he looks kind of like a dork, you know. And so there's this, and of course there's this interesting question of like, at what point do we not completely feel repulsed by Jake as a character? And some of that's contingent upon the fact that we are watching Robert De Niro. And I think when we start the film, of course there's the thing that we know, it's like, oh yeah, it's Robert De Niro. And he has some of that earthy charisma that has its roots in some of the method acting of Brando's work that he was doing with Tennessee Williams and Elia Kazan. I mean, of course, like in a lot of ways, the cinematic avatar of Jake LaMotta is something of a spiritual cousin to Stanley Kowalski from Streetcar Named Desire, in that you were seeing these two childish, brutish men sort of act in ways that are deeply violent or deeply infantile when it comes to their relationships with the women in their lives.
But what I wanted to say about, like, also with the De Niro, and like when the question, to backtrack a little bit, you know, and to asking the fine line between sympathy and repulsion, it comes to a matter of question of how much of it is his own sense of moral responsibility and personal accountability, and how much of it is him being a product of like this culture of violence that is endorsed by our country, that had been endorsed, you know, certainly in 1980 and certainly far past that, because we even get scenes like at the beginning of the movie in the first fight when, you know, they say that when he loses, even though the audience thought that was rigged, you know, that was a bad call. And it turns into a riot, like, you know, somebody throws a chair, people start fighting each other, a woman gets trampled on, and they try to, like, calm things down by playing the Star Spangled Banner on an organ. And this really happened, actually. But I think that scene, even though it happened in real life, that just culminates in a lot. I think that says a lot about, I feel, American culture and how it ties so much to male violence, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, definitely that sequence, watching the film again, that the beginning of the film, once that happened, to me, I felt like if you made that movie today and you had that scene, and people would say, oh my God, that's obvious. Like, why is that's almost too on the nose. But it really works. And it's a really soberingly prescient snapshot of this fabric of that's something of an element that's particularly prevalent in American culture, particularly for men, I think, that we white men, that so many forums and venues of recreation have been contested sites for reaffirming white masculinity. I mean, and this has a historical...
And domination. Conquest.
Well, conquest. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the film definitely continues with that thread throughout. I mean, when Jake is having to fight a number of different opponents, including, most famously, Sugar Ray Robinson, there is this, very much this racial tension that the film doesn't overly explicate, but it's felt very clearly. And there's this very much, yeah, for Jake, what's at stake is his own manhood. And I think for a lot of the white men in the audience of these brutal fights, what's at stake is their own fragile sense of masculinity. And I think, again, what's what's remarkable about Raging Bull is that it holds up a mirror to a lot of that ugliness that has been prevalent in American culture for, I mean, since its inception. Let's be honest. This is a country that was founded, I mean, in part on white colonialism and the eradication of indigenous peoples, the enslavement of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to this country. America definitely has a brutal foundation that it's built upon. And that's something that we still very clearly have a lot of trouble reckoning with. And so what I think is interesting is that without, of course, like, again, without losing sight of the story that he's telling here, Scorsese is making, he's very knowledgeable of the milieu that he's operating in and a lot of the cultural baggage that's attendant with these fights. And of course, that's all well and good. But I think to get to, I think, an initial question that we were talking about in terms of this fine line of, like, how do you balance a sense of, like, really portraying that, but then not glorifying it or taking away a sense of the dignity or agency of other characters? And I think that gets back to what we were talking about earlier, where I was just saying, how do you get to not portray this in a way that's self-pitying and glorifying or self-aggrandizing, really, and not deprive the other characters of their own dignity? And I mean, and thinking about a character like Vicky, again, there's this troubling ambiguity in terms of what her motivation is for why she chooses, for example, to stay with Jake after a particularly brutal sequence about halfway through the film. And the film never gives a pat answer as to why she chooses to stay. And I think that's something that, you know, for me, I was kind of wrestling with that question on the second viewing now of, like, what are her motivations? Is she just a blank cipher for us to kind of project something onto? Or is she, you know, of course, secondary to what Jake's going through? And I think these are all questions that are worth kind of pouring through, and I think, and picking apart and dissecting. Now, and that's all to say, though, that, again, I don't think that Moriarty's character is pushed to the side simply for the sake of allowing De Niro to parade around and have a pity party, or to be this fallen peon to lost white manhood. If anything, I think what's really admirable about the film is the way that it avoids psychologizing any of its characters. It never offers a pat explanation for anybody. We never understand why Jake is the way he is. We only just see that he... I mean, for example, like near the beginning of the film, after the opening fight, he's constantly asking his brother Joey to smack him and to, like, hit him as hard as he can, even though he's just had stitches in. And Joey asks him, why do you want me to hit you so hard? What do you get out of it? And he can't give an answer. All he can do is just give this impish, almost boyish grin, and then goes off. It's like, and to me, what's really compelling about that is that then it expands onto a broader recurring theme of masochism for Jake as a character. And again, what I think what's good about the way that Scorsese portrays Jake is that he doesn't utilize that masochism for the express purpose of having us feel sorry or give us a reason to excuse Jake's horrible behavior, because it doesn't. But what it does do is that it exposes nakedly the contradictions that underlie this man that he's trying to sort of contain and control and suppress, really, with this toxic masculinity. And I think for me, what's really powerful about Raging Bull is that it because as a film about white male rage, it shows that that rage is sustainable primarily because of people not only being unable to or incapable of, but strictly and adamantly refusing to even acknowledge, let alone discuss, the contradictions that inform any sense of male or female identity. And I think that that element of control is also reflected in a lot of the cinematography by Michael Chapman, who I don't know if we've talked about a little bit, but I mean his work here is also really superb. And the cinematography Chapman cinematography in conjunction with Schoonmaker's editing, I think, works to some brilliant effect in terms of just emphasizing the oppressive control that is exerted in even the most banal situations. Like, there's a sequence later in the film of the family getting sort of a brief interview with a journalist, and the journalist is taking some pictures of them. But the way that Schoonmaker's editing oscillates between these close-ups of the bulb from the camera flashing out and popping out, it feels violent. It feels that you don't feel like this is a domestic idyll that where everyone can have a sense of relaxation. It just feels like a repressive environment that this man tries to control, but he's not smart enough, and he's not as emotionally open to himself to really be able to control it. And by the time he realizes that, it's far too late.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And that's a kind of like a male anti-hero that I think Marty's been interested in revisiting time and again throughout his career. I mean, there's so many characters I can think of, too, who share a lot of those traits with Jake LaMotta. And I also feel like, you know, when you talk about the flashbulbs and how oppressive they are, I think actually it was the supervising sound editor, Frank Warner, who I think wanted to make them sound like, you know, like when they go off, it's more like machine guns, like, throughout the whole movie. Mm. And so I like that analogy. And I think, yeah, because you're right, it's an exploitation of this private life. And I also want to say, too, like, I think to get into...
It's exploitation, you know, aided and abetted by toxic white masculinity. I think that's the key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, speaking of Frank Warner, I want to talk about the components which I think bring out some of what we have been discussing, and I think do it effectively, and I think that's why the film works so strongly. And I think I can't, you know, I'm glad you singled out Michael Chapman, who was an incredible cinematographer. He sadly has passed away since then. Frank Warner also, I think he did an incredible job with the sound editing, like all the, you know, just the effects he came up with. You know, he actually didn't even tell Marty where he got some of the sound effects, because he told him, I just don't want to spoil the magic. And he would, you know, conjure up all these things from, like, sounds of animals to, like, the sounds of, like, dry ice against glass, screeching glass. But which would, if you hear, just hearing that, I think you'd think, oh, that sounds a little, like, pompous or portentous, you know. Oh, this could be a little silly. But I think it works because it really gives it that sort of psychological Lynchian effect on the whole movie.
I mean, it's interesting that you call it Lynchian, since, as you noted earlier, this was the same year as The Elephant Man, Lynch's second feature. And that film itself is rife with Lynchian sound design, of these ominous layers of atonal drones and clangs. But yeah, there's something really...
And they both have their lead character, their title characters, both make the proclamation that they're not an animal.
I am not an animal! I am a human being! I'm not an animal. I'm not an animal. I'm not an animal.
Right, and they're both movies actually about, in part, about dignity. And I think what's great about both of those films is that they approach that fundamental question in vastly different ways. And in the case of Raging Bull, it poses a really difficult question of I think, for a character like Jake LaMotta, what does he have to do to reclaim, not retain, but reclaim his dignity? Because he loses his dignity. I mean, he doesn't really even, I mean, whatever he has of it in the beginning of the film, it's long gone by the start of the second half. And so there's this question of, you know, when someone is, he is not an animal, he is a man, but what does he have to do to prove that he is a man? And not like a man, as we've been talking about in the sense of like this machismo image of one, but a human being.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and even there's the question of like if he proves himself again by the end. I mean, what was interesting was even in the commentary, one of the commentaries I listened to, co-writer Paul Schrader said he felt that Jake hadn't redeemed himself by the end.
Yeah,
What?
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting that the film actually leaves that. Like, I think that's a really great asset of the film, is that it completely chooses to, again, like, it doesn't offer any psychologizing for the characters, and at the end it offers you absolutely no clear indication of whether or not Jake has redeemed himself, or if it's a happy ending or a sad ending, or if he's going to continue to perpetuate this cycle. I think we've got to talk about, I mean, it's the one thing I think a lot of people sort of talk about from this film, which are the boxing scenes. I mean, we've talked a little bit about them, but, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot we can talk about. And the first thing that I wanted to mention is, I think it's remarkable is how very little they actually take up of the film. For a movie that's ostensibly about boxing, like, you know, you've been saying, Alex, there's very little boxing in it. And as a lot of you might know, that Scorsese, when he was trying to kind of work out the issues of the logistics of what he would kind of do for presenting boxing on stage, of course, the film that he looked at as inspiration was Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes. And I remember, I think I saw Raging Bull before I saw The Red Shoes. And I think a few months had passed since Raging Bull, and then I saw The Red Shoes, and I didn't know that Scorsese had taken inspiration from it until years later, and I was just like, you know, I think enough time had passed, I was like, really? But coming back to it again, you know, in all honesty, I mean, I think that there is certainly a lot of the impressionistic, or maybe not impressionistic, but there's a lot of the heightened emotion that gets carried over from the major ballet sequence from The Red Shoes, which is still a complete knockout, if you'll pardon the pun.
One of the things I love about Scorsese as a director is, I think his vast, dare I say, encyclopedic knowledge of cinema, I think, is not only the fact that he knows so much and that he can recommend so much for people to discover, but how he uses it, and he knows what kind of film or auteur style to do that would make it work appropriately for the scene. But he still makes it work on his own terms. Whether it's like that scene with the hazy look, he was actually inspired by Samuel Fuller's The Steel Helmet. Or the fact that the last fight scene against Sugar Ray Robinson, where he gets beaten to a pulp, actually and Marty actually storyboarded the whole film, and like those, you know, and very meticulously he had all storyboarded so he would know like where to set up the shots. And like that sequence, for example, which of course is unforgettable, but he was actually taking inspiration from the shower scene in Psycho, which I think if you hear that, for me, I never would have imagined like using that as sort of the foundation for shooting a boxing scene. I mean, you know.
The onslaught of violence, I mean, you can kind of see the emotional tenor, how it somehow transforms.
And it's still the sequence, the scene itself, you know, without feeling like it's derivative or, you know, indebted to another iconic scene. I think it still works so strongly on its own terms because of what the character is going through emotionally. Mm-hmm. And again, how it all comes together, the cinematography and the editing and the sound. Like, for example, there's a great moment when the sound sort of like goes quiet, and you hear a little bit of like this muffled noise, and the camera does sort of like that zoom in and out simultaneous trick as Sugar Ray is like standing there and is more backlit and as he's about to inflict the punches. And there's even a great zoom in on his fist as he raises, almost like a fist of justice, of punishment, you know, against Jake.
Not even of justice, of reckoning, of kind of, and again, yes. It's like, it is the culmination of that masochistic drive that Jake has in the film, and the film just completely doesn't hold back in terms of showing that, and I think that's what makes a lot of the boxing scenes in Raging Bull so powerful, is that the way that violence operates, it's never in service of anything greater than simply a moot point. Another justly praised sequence in the film is that montage that happens when we see these home movies of Jake and the family in color. It's the only stretch of the film that's in color. And of course, they're very rough little Super 8 millimeter home movies, and they are paired against these still photographs, sometimes photographs that kind of blur into each other or kind of approximate some sort of a movement of Jake back in the ring. The music accentuates kind of this precarious, ephemeral stature of this domestic bliss that never really is or never really was. Because, and it's weird to say that, like, when we see the color footage in the film, which should be the most realistic aesthetic vision of the film, it feels in a lot of ways, despite all the slow motion, despite all of the extraordinary sound design in the boxing ring, that color footage with no audio whatsoever feels the most unreal in the rest of the film. Do you agree, Alex, or is that just kind of my perspective?
I initially was thinking, like, when I saw that sequence and with the music, I thought it's like this idyllic period where, you know, he's maintaining a career for himself, but he's also managing to, like, make a family of his own. But I think you're absolutely right. And it was when I was listening to like, you know, commentaries and interviews, like hearing Marty talk about it. And actually when he was researching for the film, him and the writers, he had seen the actual color home movie footage that Jake had shot with his family. And he said that for him, they're very powerful to watch because, and he actually said he felt like you get more of an idea of a picture of Jake and his life, and domestic life, than his own movie does, because he felt like with the home movies, you could see sort of through the facade of, like, this marriage and this family breaking apart. So, yeah, I completely agree with you on that. And so I think it's interesting, yeah, and I like that you singled out, too, the contrast between the use of color and what's the majority of it being black and white. So it's almost like there's more of, a raw emotional honesty that's coming out throughout the majority of the film that's certainly not there in the home movie footage. And that made me want to ask you a question, though, because I wanted to hear your response and your thoughts on this. But do you think the film works as it is being shot in black and white?
Unquestionably. Unquestionably. I mean, I can't conceive of a version of Raging Bull that's in color. I mean, to me, the black and white photography situates the film as something of a period piece whilst simultaneously helping the film avoid from becoming dated. And with something like Raging Bull, that also is rooted, I would argue, within the Italian neorealist tradition, in that Scorsese is trying, he's not slavish to the constraints of realism, but he's very aware and conscious of them, and he's absolutely implementing them throughout the film. And yet he
knows when he wants to take liberties with authenticity, or he doesn't try to make, for example, none of the boxing sequences, I'd argue, in the film are meant to come across as realistic.
No.
They're all impressionistic or stylized. Hmm. And I also feel like I completely agree with you, and also I feel like with the black and white, I think if it was in color, it would be glaring and would be a little distracting, potentially. I mean, it's like there's a story where actually they had shot color footage tests of De Niro in costume, like when he was training and trying to get in shape, you know, as Jake. And Marty showed it to Michael Powell. And as they were watching the footage together, you know, Powell's like, you know, it looks nice, but there's something wrong. And it's like, what is it? The gloves, they're the wrong color, you know, like these bright red, you know, they should be oxblood red. And Marty realized, oh, of course, he's right. And that was just one of the things that inspired him to realize maybe we should shoot this in black and white. That, and also the fact that there were lots of other boxing films that were coming around that time that were in color, like Rocky II, and there was the Champ remake by Franco Zeffirelli with John Voight. So you made the argument to United Artists, like, yeah, you know, this would make us kind of stand out. And, to give them credit, like, United Artists gave them carte blanche to do whatever they wanted. But I think
even though it came out about 8 years earlier, which was, quite a bit of time, I would say probably the closest in terms of tone as a boxing movie to Raging Bull, John Huston's Fat City, that was shot in color. And to me, like, I like Fat City as a film, but it's certainly, I think it would have actually worked even better as a black and white film. I mean, that's just me, though.
No, I agree with you. And there is something about, like, you're right, looking back towards time. And I think because there, I think in a way it helps to maintain a sort of a right amount of distance for us, but not too distant that we ever, like, look down and we belittle or wag our fingers.
So, I guess kind of wrapping it up, because we've been talking about it for quite some time now, how do you feel Raging Bull holds up in 2020?
In the year 2020, I think that, you know, I would actually encourage people to watch a film like Raging Bull. And it's, and I feel like when it comes down to, I mean, I can't control or influence what everybody's reactions are going to be. Because I think, sadly, there are some people who would still look at this guy and see him as like this tragic hero. But I think that overall, more often than not, I think people can look and see, again, looking back to this portrait and seeing how far, and this is what Martin Scorsese has shown time and time again, of how we as a country have had this issue, this problem of how we've had violence become so deeply rooted in our culture and in our psyche, and how we must, if we are to really move forward and to evolve and to become better people and a better society, we must come to terms with it. We must come face to face with it. And even if you take that social contextualization aside, I think, of course, the filmmaking stands up 150%. I mean, it's, of course, it's one of those movies that film students can always look at and be inspired by, revisit again and again, you know, to watch different sequences and figure out how, what, you know, it's the essentials of how you edit and shoot and act a scene out. So I think it's an important film, an essential film, and everybody should see it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not gonna go on too much because I think you've encompassed a lot of what I was going to say about the film. I mean, I think it's the sort of film that I would recommend. I wouldn't recommend to everybody. I think because I think it is a very difficult film to watch, and it's something that, you know, neither of us think that the film commits false hero worship. I, again, of course, that'll depend on certain viewers maybe misreading the film, but I don't think that that's the fault of the filmmakers. I mean, that is to say that I think that there's a lot, again, to justify why to revisit a movie like Raging Bull in a pop culture climate that is full of movies about wounded white men. Why do we need to see a film about a white male antihero in 2020? And I think, like you were saying, the reason why is because unlike a lot of its imitators and unlike some of its some of the successors over the years, Raging Bull has distinguished itself by simply being brutally honest about itself, about its main character. And I think it's also Scorsese trying to be honest with himself. And I think it's that degree of honesty, or that attempt at honesty, without pathologizing, without making psychological platitudes, without offering pat excuses, that really lends the film a sense of unvarnished, well-earned pathos, which I think, if hopefully viewed within the right context, can generate a lot of really fruitful conversation and dialogue. I mean, and that's just simply the emotional core of the film. And none of that would be worth anything if the film itself, as you were saying, wasn't so well made and wasn't ripe and rich with so many just masterful examples of great filmmaking. So I would say it's a very hard film to watch, and it's one that I don't know if I'd recommend to everybody, but if you definitely have the fortitude to see it, I think it's a really rewarding film, and it's a tough film, but it's a rewarding film, and it's one that I think again, it does, I think, what some of the very best of art can do, which is try to make us have a very honest and often painful conversations about ourselves and about how we reconcile the most negative components of ourselves, which are propagated within cultural and social contexts, and how to dispel those and be better for ourselves and be better for the people that we love. So it's a powerful film, and it's a great film.
It is. And I'll just say this, that I feel like whether or not you think Jake LaMotta is redeemed at the end of Martin Scorsese's portrayal of him, but I feel like I'm more confident in saying that actually I feel like the process of making this movie was in many ways a redemption for Marty himself. Well, you know, since last week I talked about a film I saw during one of the festivals, I figured I would talk about another film I saw at a festival, this one from the New York Film Festival. It's a very long one, but I think that if you have the time and patience to sit down and watch it, I think that you will find it quite rewarding, and that is Frederick Wiseman's four-hour doc, City Hall. And I don't know, have you seen City Hall, Nick?
No, I haven't, but I have seen some of Frederick Wiseman's other work.
Yeah, and this is going to be interesting to hear, folks, but this is actually the first Frederick Wiseman film I have seen. So I came in to his filmmaking style cold, essentially. But for a first-time experience for me watching Wiseman, I really liked it. I think it's very good. And what I really liked about it is that it doesn't have a plot, per se, in the traditional sense. It's more kind of like an observational study of the day-to-day existence of seeing how the municipal government of Boston, like we see not just Mayor Marty Walsh, but one of the things that I really liked about the film is the way it really shows the community of it. Like, we get to see, the film opens and cuts back to a few times we see the city correspondence, and we see, like, the mayor talking with people, like, trying to, we see what his schedule is like, but we also get to see all these people that he interacts with. And I think it makes for a very effective film because of how it really, I think, reminds us of, like, how we can, I know that it sounds cliche to say, like, making this, a parable about, like, Americana or America at its best. But I think what I really like about the film is how you see how it's interconnected to the municipal government and to all these different committees and organizations and communities. And again, to see, like, a leader who comes across as a guy who's genuinely trying to empathize and connect with people. Like, even at one point he talks with some people who were recovered from alcohol abuse and drug abuse, and he said he himself was an alcoholic for several years. And so, you know, seeing all, you know, that sense of solidarity and unity and community, I think we need to see more films like that today, especially because, as we've mentioned time and again, but how it's, you know, it's really become prevalent, that sense of isolation that everyone's experiencing, and how I think a lot of people kind of dismiss or neglect to really think about how interconnected we all are as a nation, or even just in our very own city.
Yeah, you know, it's, well, let me tell you this. If you liked this a lot, you're going to really like a lot of Wiseman's other work. I mean, Frederick Wiseman has had an enormous body of work. He's been making documentaries for, 60 plus years now. And he's in his 90s. And, you know, the most recent of his films that I saw was from about 3 years ago. It was Ex Libris, the New York Public Library, which is, I would recommend, if you like this one a lot, Alex, I would check that one out. It's slightly shorter than City Hall at 3.5 hours, but I think it taps into a lot of what you identified in terms of Wiseman's recognizable traits as a filmmaker, in terms of that he completely eschews interviews. He has a very observational style of where he's, as he's noted before in interviews and as a lot of critics have noted before, he is a chronicler of American institutions, of how they operate, how they're related with each other. And he extols a lot of the virtues of these institutions, whilst at the same time not being completely oblivious to some of their shortcomings. So I can't comment on City Hall, but it's definitely one when I realized that it was screening earlier this year in Venice, I was just, I was like, oh, maybe that'll come to LFF. It didn't, sadly, but I'm hoping that I get around to watching it. And yeah, I'm really, really glad that your first exposure to Frederick Wiseman was a positive one. And I can't wait for you to dive into some of his other stuff.
Yeah, I certainly will. And yeah, I was really glad that I had such a positive first experience with this filmmaker. And yeah, I agree with you how he's just capturing what's around. And he doesn't try to, like, put himself in front of the camera or do voiceover or any of that. And I think it makes for gives a very enlightening experience, I would say. What about you?
Well, you know, I don't know if, I mean, I certainly didn't have quite the Frederick Wiseman experience in terms of my recommendation of the week, but I did watch a good bit of patient filmmaking, I would say. Some would call it slow cinema. Some might even call Wiseman's film slow cinema. I mean, I don't think I would, because it's not. But, I mean, it requires patience in a different way. And that is Simon Liang's 2003 feature, Goodbye, Dragon Inn. And we were talking. Yeah.
I remember we talked about that briefly.
Yeah, we briefly talked about it when we were talking about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and its placement within the Wuxia genre, and of course, the King Hu film, Dragon Inn. And this film is very much about a cinema in Taiwan that is closing its doors. And the last film that it's screening is King Hu's 1967 martial arts classic, Dragon Inn. Now, the film charts, it's about 82 minutes or so, and it unfolds not quite in full real time over the entirety of Dragon Inn, but it does follow several characters kind of navigating through the theater throughout the majority of the film. And the two characters that we follow primarily are a ticket seller, who's played by Chen Xiangqi. She's an employee of the cinema who never speaks in the film. Actually, there's really no dialogue in the film for quite a good stretch of it. And she surveys the cinema. She walks around. She has a limp, and she's just sort of going around the entire cinema, kind of looking into the hallways, inspecting the restrooms, and pursuing the affections of a projectionist who we do not see for most of the film until the very end. I mean, I won't give away who plays the projectionist, but anybody who's familiar with Simon Liang's work will probably have a good guess about who plays him. The other character that we follow is a Japanese tourist who's played by Mitamura Kiyonobu, and he essentially just is a member of the audience, and what he does is he just kind of traverses through a lot of the empty rows, and as well as other parts of the cinema, including back rooms and the men's restroom, in search of potential participants in sexual trysts. And it's interesting, you know, for a filmmaker like Simon Liang, who's known for, by reputation, if you're not that familiar with him, you would imagine, for a guy who has who's known for slow cinema, and make no mistake, Goodbye Dragon Inn is a slow film. There are a lot of static shots of just observing characters moving through space, particularly one very long shot, wide shot of the empty cinema near the end that lasts for well over 5 minutes. But the film is far from severe or overly grave. In fact, it's often quite funny. And this is nowhere more apparent than in the character of the Japanese tourist who's trying to find someone to engage in some sort of liaison with, or trying to watch the film whilst, for example, a woman behind him is loudly eating fried watermelon seeds. And the first moment he has a conversation with somebody, it's a fellow Japanese stranger who says the first words of dialogue in the entire film. And the first lines of dialogue are him asking, "Don't you know that this theater is haunted?" It's a great first line because it subtly positions the film, or it subtly signals this transition of the film from something of a banal Portrait of the Everyday into something of a ghost story. Now, whether the ghosts actually exist or not, Cy never confirms. He doesn't need to. What he does is he just simply evokes the phantom of a place like these old movie houses, which resemble a lot of the ones that the one that he was growing up with when he was a young boy in Malaysia. And the film has certainly drawn the admiration and the love of a lot of fellow East Asian filmmakers who also grew up in similar movie houses. Like Apichipong Verasithakul has expressed a lot of affection for Goodbye Dragon, and because of his own connection to similar movie houses like this. But then to take an even more metatextual level, the film actually has two of the actors from Goodbye Dragon Inn appear as members of the audience. The actors Chun Shi and Miao Tian as themselves. But then we have to ask ourselves, are they really in the audience? Are they themselves ghosts? I mean, they're not ghosts in the literal sense that they're dead, but are they not phantoms of a bygone era of filmmaking? And that's the fundamental question that a movie like Dragon Inn is asking. At what point does the past emanate from a place? What constitutes a ghost or something that haunts our imagination? And he pinpoints that somewhere between the intersection of an edifice and routine. And within that routine, Cy signals in some very key moments, without any sense of saccharine sentimentality, the transcendent power and redemptive quality of cinema. It was just recently released by the Blu-ray and DVD label Second Run, and a brand new 4K restoration, and the film looks absolutely gorgeous on a big screen. I know that a lot of cinemas are closed, and watching a film like this is just simply not going to be the same if you watch it on your tablet or even on your TV at home, because the film is about a cinema, and by putting so much emphasis on the cinema space, on these long corridors, on these imbricated doorways upon doorways that lead into this derelict cavern of an old cinema that's leaking water from rainfall that's constantly been pouring outside, or that's seen much better days. What Cy is doing is he's mirroring our own occupation of the cinematic experiential space. And in that respect, Goodbye Dragon Inn is a quietly clever, yet deeply generous paean to the power of movie making. It's a really quiet, unassuming, unpretentious, lovely film. And I'm so glad that it's been restored and being made available now for a new generation of cinephiles to rediscover for themselves, either at home or on the big screen with an audience or by themselves. Definitely check it out.
One of the things I have noticed about him as a director and that I find fascinating is, like, especially for a guy who makes what a lot of people consider to be slow cinema, is the way he likes to transition between realism and more of a fantastical kind of impressionistic kind of filmmaking style. And how it can, more often than not, I feel like, catch the audience off guard. So I find that very interesting about him as a director. But yeah, I'm glad you liked it. And I still would be interested in seeing more of his works, too, along with other auteurs of the new Taiwan cinema.
Well, if there are biopics like Raging Bull that you would want to recommend to us, definitely let us know in the comments. Shoot us a message. We're always keen to hear what you guys have to say. And if there are any Scorsese films that you think are better than Raging Bull, I'm very curious to hear what some of your guys' favorites are. I mean, I know that there are a couple that I really love, and Raging Bull is definitely among the top, but I'm curious to hear if there's anybody who wants to make the case against it for being a great film. Same goes for Goodbye Dragon Inn, because I know Goodbye Dragon Inn is something of a controversial pick among some purists of Simon Liang's cinema. If you love it, or if you think that it's something of a weird anomaly in his career, or if you have any other recommendations for what some of his better works from the 90s, I'm curious to hear about that. And of course, finally, if you're at all familiar with Frederick Wiseman's output, I really want to hear a lot about what some of his earlier films are like, and if we can find them, because I think, you know, the more we're able to access the body of work of such an important American filmmaker and chronicler like Frederick Wiseman, I think the better off we will be. as a movie-going public and as an informed democratic society, frankly.
But in the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you have a great day.
Thank you guys once again for taking yet another trip with us through cinema history. We just hope, as always, that you stay well, be safe, and as always, continue watching great movies.
And remember, we're all in this together.